latest picture of Alistair Ashcroft from her pocket and handed it over the fence. "Is this the man?" The old lady squinted at it.
"That's him. Only his hair was different. Same eyes, though. Yes, that's the fella."
She passed the photo back. As Marie took it from her, she saw Max walking round the side passageway.
"This lady here says that Ashcroft was visiting Larry, but he's been away for weeks."
"With his sister in Weymouth?" asked Max.
"Weymouth?"
The neighbour stared at him.
"He never mentioned no Weymouth. I thought his sister was abroad, teaching English in some Belgium college."
"Really?"
Max looked at Marie. "Time to effect an entry, as they say. What do you think?"
"Agreed.
Thanks, Mrs...
You've been a great help."
They went back round to the front.
"I've already checked the windows, and this is too tough to shoulder in," Max said, pushing at the door.
"I'll ring and get an enforcer brought over," Marie said. While they waited, to Marie's surprise, the next door neighbour appeared carrying two mugs of tea.
"I watch them cop dramas on the telly, so I know you'll be wanting this. If you want sugar, I'll go and get it. My name's Betty, by the way."
"This is great. Thanks, Betty."
Marie smiled at her.
"Tell me, what sort of man is Larry, other than private?"
"Hard to say." Betty's brow creased in concentration. "He's not your typical yellow belly," she said, using the local term for people born and bred in Lincolnshire. "Really does keep himself to himself. Never once seen a lady friend visit. And he doesn't go down to the local for a pint with the lads. Tell you the truth, I'd be a bit worried about him if he was my boy."
"And how often did the man in the photo visit, Betty?" Marie asked.
"Quite a bit over the last month. I was pleased to see Larry had a friend at last, but then he got ill. I think it's what you call a nervous breakdown. Anyway, after that, the friend came less often," she shrugged. "And that's it, really."
It was 10 minutes before the vehicle with the enforcer arrived. They stared at the as-yet-unopened door.
"I hate this bit," Max said.
Marie knew what he meant. It was a feeling she should have got used to after so many years in the job, but probably no one did. Excitement of what you might find, yet also fear of the same thing. With a crack of rending wood, the enforcer broke through. Max went in first, with Marie at his heels. They moved from room to room, but nothing seemed out of place other than the things lying on the hall floor.
"A bit odd, wouldn't you say, Sarge?"
Max looked puzzled.
"I'd be expecting to see more upheaval."
Marie looked around, trying to get a feel for what Larry Turner was like. The house gave little away. There were a few photos, all related to work, mostly of Turner and his mates in uniform, toting their rifles. There were some medals in a case, and a few highly polished trophies, and a pretty impressive sound system and record deck. But other than that and some shooting magazines, the place was almost bare. And it was an exclusively male domain, with nothing about it indicating a woman's touch. No attempt to make the place a home. They avoided disturbing the things in the hall just in case this turned out to be a crime scene, and started up the stairs. Marie was almost certain that they were going to find the mortal remains of authorised firearms officer PC Larry Turner, yet that kind of discovery was usually preceded by the unforgettable stench of decaying flesh. This house smelt a little musty, as any would if it had been locked up for some time, but other than that she smelt nothing. So why this sense of foreboding? She kept thinking about the way the real Ezra Lorimer had been callously terminated when his usefulness ended. Surely it would have been the same with this man. With every step, her trepidation mounted. Max had slowed down too. Glancing at him, Marie guessed he felt as she did. They reached a short landing with three doors leading off it, each one firmly shut. Max took a determined breath and opened the first. Marie looked into a small family bathroom. It was clean, functional, and tiled to the ceiling in silvery faux marble high-gloss tiles. There was a white bath and a shower cubicle, basin and toilet. On the windowsill was a china toothbrush holder with a single brush and the usual toothpaste. Towels still hung over the heated towel rail, all pristine. She'd been in hotel bathrooms less immaculate.
Max pulled the door closed and, with a glance at her, opened the second door. What was intended as the guest bedroom was being used as Larry's study and gun room. Along one wall was a desk with a laptop and a letter rack, and rather incongruously, a retro-design Mathmos lava lamp.
"Rocket Telstar," Max crooned. "My favourite."
Marie shook her head. "Well, I learn something new about you every day, Max Korn." She turned her attention to the rest of the room. Basically gun cabinets and a workbench with cans of oil, soft cloths and a variety of other tins and bottles. The bad thing about it was that the cabinet doors were all wide open, and there were some very conspicuous gaps in the rows of guns.
"Blood."
Max pointed to a stain on the carpet, close to one of the cabinets.
"I thought it was spilt oil, but it's blood all right."
It looked as though she had been right to be concerned.
"We'll finish our sweep and then ring this in. We'll need forensics, and we'll need to check how many guns are licensed under his name to know how many and which are missing."
She ran her eyes over the room again, but saw nothing else by way of evidence.
"Okay, last room coming up," said Max, and swallowed.
Marie stepped forward and pushed the door open. For a moment, nothing she saw computed. Then she smelt it.
"Oh, dear Lord. What has he done this time?"
Max slipped in past her and stopped in his tracks.
"Fucking hell.
Ring Jackman now, Max. Tell him we have another victim and we need Rory here pronto." She closed her eyes, but the scene remained seared into the back of her eyelids. It had to be Larry Turner, but only forensics would tell her that. The body lay on the bed in a recumbent position, reminding her of pictures she'd seen of mummified Egyptian pharaohs, except the bandages had been replaced by heavy-duty cling film, the wide stuff that they used for packing furniture for transport. From what she could make out, the victim had been stripped and then wrapped into a tight cocoon. From the amount of blood within the package, she guessed that this person had met the same end as Ezra Lorimer. He looked like a giant side of meat ready for the freezer. Because of the wrapping, very little smell had leaked out into the atmosphere, but Marie could see that in places fluids were starting to seep onto the bed linen. If he'd been left much longer, the smell would have been unbearable. Marie thanked God she hadn't made forensics her career.
Imagine having to deal with this abomination.
As soon as the words were out, she hated herself for them. This abomination was another living, feeling human being who'd fallen foul of Alistair Ashcroft's twisted mind. Another police officer. Max touched her shoulder.
"Jackman's on his way, Sarge. He's asked for a priority on forensics."
He stared at the bed and its occupant.
"If only I was religious, I feel I should be saying a prayer for that poor guy."
Marie turned to go.
"We've seen enough."
Alistair Ashcroft hurried away from the church. The voices and the clamour were becoming hard to bear, and he'd been planning to spend a little time in the quiet of the old building. But as he had turned into the road, he'd seen more people milling about by the foyer than usual, and warning bells had rung. There were no uniforms in sight, but he had a strong feeling that Jackman had put two and two together regarding the church. He gritted his teeth. Now where to go? There was no time to drive out to one of his wild places on the marsh. He had too much to do. He got into his car and drove to a small car park that looked out over the river. It was never busy, being too far away from the shops in the town centre, and today it was almost empty. It would have to do. He paid for an hour, locked the car, and found a narrow footpath that ran down to some old disused moorings. Occasionally a lone fisherman would try his luck there, but today there was no one in sight. Ashcroft sank down onto a low seat that the fisherman used and stared at the greenish, murky water of the river. This was what he needed, quiet and solitude, some peace in which to unravel the twisted, tangled mess of his thoughts. Some of these involved Paul Lorimer. The urge to kill that stupid boy was almost more than he could bear, but he needed him for his plan. And he needed to fulfill that plan, to gaze upon the lifeless bodies of Rowan Jackman and his Marie, before he could leave this dead and alive hole forever. By the time he stood up again some 30 minutes later, the last detail of his plan was in place, and he felt almost serene. He ought to know by now that these temporary malfunctions in his thought processes were to be expected. After all, the stupidity of those with whom he came in contact was sometimes more than he could bear. Even Jackman had turned out to be a disappointment. At least his frustration was slightly appeased by the thought of the strain he had subjected the entire Salton police force to. Most satisfying of all had been his relentless harassment of that young PC. He had chosen Kevin Stoner, having noted his compassion towards the street people of Salton, plus the fact that he was homosexual and therefore more vulnerable. Ashcroft had no real sense of what he subjected others to, being entirely without empathy himself. Like a feral child, he'd had no family to model himself on. "I'm the invisible man," Ashcroft said to himself, "and so I'm invulnerable." He laughed. Poor Jackman, and poor Marie. Soon they would be paying the price for proving such unworthy opponents. By midnight, Alistair Ashcroft would be on his way to a new life, a new campaign. He started his car. "Now for Paul Lorimer." Ashcroft turned off the engine again. It had come to him to wonder what made him so particularly angry towards that stupid boy. He thought of Paul tied to that chair, powerless and trembling in fear. Fear of the unknown, dread of the coming pain and humiliation. Himself, as a child, how he'd hated that weak and feeble boy. Well, he was that child no longer. He had molded himself into a new man, someone unique, and he would show his uniqueness by sparing the life of Paul Lorimer, who was least worthy of being spared. Chapter 32. Robbie Melton waved the printouts from the vehicle checks. "We've picked up the car, sir, on several different occasions. We can pretty well pinpoint the direction he travels in. He always heads towards the east side of town. Uniform have upped their presence in all the residential roads within a 1 mile radius of where he was last caught on camera." Soon he would be face to face with Ashcroft again. Jackman felt it in his bones. There was no doubt that they were drawing closer. Their arch enemy had made a crucial mistake in not realizing that the Sniper Experience Gun Club had so many CCTV cameras. Then there was his grotesque killing of Larry Turner. The neighbor had verified that Larry's new friend drove a car of the same make and color as the one recorded on those CCTV cameras. Unless he had changed it very recently, it would only be a matter of time before he went through either a police traffic camera or past an eagle-eyed Bobby or PCSO. Then every traffic car in the area would be after him, blue lights flashing and sirens blazing. Robbie lowered his voice. "I knew Larry Turner, boss, a couple of years before I transferred here. I went on a firearms course and Larry was on it too. He was a good guy. He was dead keen to get into the national team, the target shooting championships and all that. He was pretty obsessive about it. But I guess we all have to have a passion, don't we?"
"Not sure what mine is," murmured Jackman. "Other than Laura Archer."
"I reckon it's policing for you, sir. Oh, and horses."
"Horses I can go with, but not the policing part."
Robbie intuited what he was referring to. "Ashcroft can't keep himself hidden for much longer, sir. Our guys on the streets are looking at everyone sideways now, including any iffy-looking women, if you know what I mean." Jackman went back to his office. All his bravado of a few moments ago evaporated as soon as he was alone. Doubts flooded in. Was Ashcroft becoming disorganized? Would this mean they had a better chance of catching him? Or would he instead become a desperate and dangerous loose cannon? And what then? This was no good. In order to give himself something to do, he rang Kevin.
"Jackman here, just checking on how you are."
Kevin said that he was still shaken but felt much better. His parents were treating him like a 5-year-old with the measles, but he was kind of enjoying it. In a few days, he and Alan were driving down to Cornwall for a week in a friend's holiday cottage.
"Son,
sea and vodka, sir, along with Cornish pasties. Alan reckons that should cure anything.
Greatly relieved, Jackman phoned Laura, who answered almost immediately.
Sweetheart, I was just going to ring you. Sam's recovering, and they're no longer concerned about him. Isn't that fantastic?
And Ruth Crook was amazing. She organized a private room under a false name for security.
Will you be okay if I stay with him, darling? They've offered me a temporary bed here for the night.
Actually, Jackman didn't want her out of his sight, but being with Sam under heavy police guard would be a damn sight safer than being with him.
Just keep in touch, won't you?
He said. And if anything bothers you... Laura interrupted him. He wasn't to worry. She was taking no chances at all.
Boss? Marie stuck her head around his door. We're back. Rory is busy at the crime scene, and he said to tell you he'd rather you didn't send him any more like this one. Even he felt queasy.
I'm not surprised. Jackman grimaced. He shook his head to rid it of the memory of that corpse, wrapped like a parcel in cling film.
Now, have you heard from Rachel Lorimer about her son? Is he home yet?
Rang her just now, sir. She's much more relaxed. He's not back yet, but she said he'd rung home. He said he'd gone looking for Ashcroft again, but he'd be home by nightfall if he had no luck.
Jackman frowned. This wasn't good news.
One thing does bother me, boss. When I spoke to Jacob about the horse theft and the other stuff, he told me he never lied. He said his ma had told him to always tell the truth and shame the devil. He's a simple-minded kid, and I think if he said Paul had a gun, then he did have one.
If he's roaming the streets of Salton hunting for Ashcroft, why haven't any of our foot soldiers picked him up?
Every unit out there has his description, Jackman said.
What's he up to? Murmured Marie. I dread to think, but I don't believe his story about getting rat-arsed, do you?
You know I don't, sir.
Jackman smiled, then his expression became serious. Paul Lorimer needs to be found before nightfall.
The man he knew as Ralph Renwick sat back in his chair and slowly applauded.
Well done. As near perfect as we could expect from you, young man.
He was taking the piss, surely. Suddenly Paul had the urge to reach out and strangle this man.
Now, all we have to do is go over the timing again.
Paul gave a sigh.
He knew the times, for goodness sake.
Do we have to, Ralph? I've got it all in my head, honestly.
Once more. For the first time, Paul looked this man directly in the eyes. They were heavy-lidded like those of a cat, and as cold. Suddenly he was afraid.
Sure, let's do it.
Good. Now listen to me very carefully.
Ralph Renwick ran through the times while Paul repeated them.
Finally, Renwick bent down and whispered in his ear.
Your acting was very good. But just to give it an edge, remember this. If you mess up, get even one word out of place, this is what will happen to your ma.
Renwick leaned closer until Paul could feel his breath on his cheek and whispered in his ear. Paul gasped.
I won't let you down. I won't. No, you won't. Because ruin my plans, and I'll ruin your mother. And maybe that pretty sister of yours, too.
Paul's voice cracked.
I won't get it wrong, I promise.
Renwick stood up abruptly, the smile back in place, but the eyes just as hard.
Then this is yours.
He pushed a thick envelope into Paul's hands.
Put on the best show of your life, and then go home and forget everything, understand?
There is enough money there to wipe the last few days from your memory forever.
Is that clear?
All Paul could do was nod, bewildered, understanding nothing. As the shadows lengthened across the fen at close of day, Rachel Lorimer made her way to her daughter's caravan. As ever, Rachel wondered at the way the girl lived, surrounded by heaps of clutter. But by now she'd accepted that Esther wouldn't change.
"Is there anything you need to tell me, girl?"
she asked softly. Esther lowered her head.
You gave Paul a gun, didn't you?
Esther shook her head slowly.
Didn't give it. He took it.
I see.
She gave her only daughter a sad smile.
It's all right, Esther. I just needed to know.
She endeavoured to widen the smile.
And one other thing. A certain item that belonged to your grandfather. Do you have it somewhere in this,
She waved an arm around. Esther looked up.
Are you mad at me, Ma?
No, girl, I'm not mad at you.
She paused for a moment, Esther watching.
There is something I want you to do for me, for all of us. It's to do with your brother Paul.
Sure, Ma. What do you want me to do?
Good girl. Now, I've heard from Paul, and it's like this.
There was an unusual atmosphere in the station that evening. Though their shift had finished some time ago, only now were the team beginning to drift off home. The first to go had been Max, wanting to get back to Rosie and the children, but the others almost had to be thrown out. Now, even though there seemed little point in staying, Jackman, Marie, and Gary sat on, listening to the reports coming in from the streets of Salton-le-Fen. The uniformed officers had narrowed the search for Ashcroft's base to an area roughly half a mile wide. They were now out in force, knocking on doors and requesting to look in outbuildings and garages to try to locate the black Peugeot car that they now knew Ashcroft drove. Every policeman and woman had the license number branded in their memory. Jackman stretched and yawned.
I think it's time we called it a day, or we'll feel like rubbish tomorrow. There's little we can do here, other than wait.
Or in your case, pace up and down. Do you realise you're wearing a track in your office carpet? Murray said.
It was true. He felt uncommonly edgy, and seemed incapable of sitting down for any length of time.
Jackman, I know this sounds a bit dramatic, but would you like to stay over with us tonight?
Marie looked at him anxiously.
You said Laura is staying with Sam at the hospital and Ashcroft knows exactly where you live, doesn't he? I don't think you are safe there alone.
I second that, sir, added Gary. I've been thinking that if he's realising that the net is tightening, he might want to end the whole thing while he still has the chance.
I've got a sofa bed. It won't take a minute to make it up, Marie said. We'd feel a lot happier.
It was tempting. Ashcroft had already visited Mill Corner twice.
Please, Jackman?
He wanted to say yes.
I appreciate your offer, really I do, but...
How could he tell her he was half hoping to find Ashcroft lurking in his carport?
One night, sir. I've got toiletries and shaving gear that you can borrow, Gary said.
Before Jackman could answer, his mobile rang. It was an unknown number, and it took a few moments to realise who was speaking. He switched the loudspeaker on.
Calm down, Paul. Now start again, but slowly.
He's got Ma. That man what I thought was Uncle Ezra. You have to help her, you have to.
Paul sounded so frantic it was hard to make out the words.
Tell me what you know, Paul. Where has he taken your mother? Do you know that?
I did it wrong.
Paul was crying now.
He said he'd hurt her, and Esther too, if I got it wrong and I messed up.
Got what wrong? Asked Jackman.
Phone calls. I had to make phone calls, and I got the times wrong. Now he's taken Ma.
Where are you? We'll come and get you.
Jackman spoke calmly.
You can't. He'll be back soon. And if he sees you here, he'll kill her. I know he will.
Tell me where you are, Paul.
He scribbled a note and held it out to Gary. Get location of this call. Gary hurried out.
He's here. I'll try to ring back.
The line went dead. For a moment, Jackman stared at his phone. Then he sprang into action.
Marie, ring Rachel Lorimer now.
Marie pulled out her mobile, rang the number and switched the loudspeaker on.
Hi, Levi. Can I speak to Rachel, please? It's DS Evans and it's urgent.
She's not here, Sergeant. She went out to talk to Esther earlier on, but when I went over to her van, neither of them was there. I'm getting real worried about them.
Jackman's heart sank.
So, Ashcroft hadn't finished with the Lorimers after all. Marie asked Levi exactly what time he realized that she had gone, and he said it must have been over 30 minutes before.
"And her car's not here, Sergeant. But she never goes out at night. She hates driving these lanes in the dark. Scares her rigid."
"Levi, please ring me if she comes back. Immediately, okay? Meanwhile, we'll do what we can. You and the rest of the family stay put, and an officer will be with you shortly."
Marie ended the call, just as Gary came back in.
"Can't specify an address, but the nearest tower gives us a general location of the area where Uniform are searching for Ashcroft's car."
Gary handed Jackman a list of 6 road names.
"Inform the duty sergeant of the situation, Gary. Ask him to keep the police presence low-key, but to keep their eyes peeled for any signs of trouble or sightings of Rachel Lorimer or her old 4x4.
"Got you, boss."
As Gary turned to go, Marie said,
"And ask for a crew to get out to the Lorimer place ASAP. See if they can get a more accurate time for when Rachel left, and get them to keep an eye on those boys. We have no idea how they will react with the mother and sister missing."
Jackman followed the tracks in his carpet, pacing. What to do? With a grunt, he sank down into his chair and pointed to the one on the opposite side of his desk. "Sit, Marie. We need to assess what we really know and how to proceed." Marie shook her head.
"Very little. Just some garbled story from a young man who is behaving totally out of character."
"If he was acting, I'd be very surprised," Jackman countered. "And if he's telling the truth, we have 2 women in mortal danger. And don't forget they are off the radar at present."
"Okay. Let's assume he's telling the truth. Do we think Ashcroft actually abducted them? Or possibly lured them away from the farm?"
He thought for a moment.
"I'd say the second option. He lured them.
He'd know he couldn't take his car. He could have phoned Rachel and told her that Paul was in trouble or hurt, and she needed to come immediately."
Marie nodded slowly.
"That's quite feasible. Plus, if she hates driving at night, she might well have taken Esther with her."
She pulled a face.
"But then, why not tell the family? She only had to say she was going to collect their brother, and none of them would have been worried about her."
"Oh, you know Ashcroft, Marie. He could have invented 12 plausible reasons for not telling anyone."
"Very true. But Rachel Lorimer's a law unto herself. She does only what she wants to, always has."
"Then maybe Ashcroft knew that, and tried a different method, like using Paul himself."
"He did say he'd been told to make phone calls, didn't he?"
Marie paused, thinking.
"So, bottom line, we go with Ashcroft having Rachel and Esther."
"We can't afford not to, can we? We just have to hope that either Uniform spots something or Paul manages to ring us back."
A few minutes later, Gary returned.
"The sergeant understands the situation and has put out an attention drawn to Rachel and her daughter, with the order to proceed in that area with extreme caution."
He turned to Marie.
"And 2 officers are on the way up to the Lorimer farm as we speak."
He looked from her to Jackman.
"Do you think we should call the team back in?"
Jackman shook his head. "No, not yet. There's nothing they can do at the moment. It's a waiting game, I'm afraid. Gary, would you be up for going out and meeting those PCs at the Lorimer place? You know what the Lorimer boys are like. A couple of coppers with no prior dealings with them could inadvertently upset young Jacob, causing Noah to flare up."
"Of course," said Gary immediately. "That's a good point, and I'll keep in touch in case they hear anything from the mother."
Marie followed Gary out, off to get her and Jackman a drink. Jackman was left alone with his thoughts. Completely out of the blue, he recalled a man named Tyler Kane. Many years ago, he had worked with this rather enigmatic detective, who had held some very unorthodox and unpolicemanlike views. Kane believed firmly in karma, and he and Jackman would sometimes talk well into the night, pitting his rather unworldly ideas against Jackman's materialistic ones. In particular, Jackman recalled Tyler Kane's method of dealing with fear. He could hear him now.
"We coppers love an acronym, Jackman, so use this one. FEAR. False evidence appearing real. Most of our fears are just a collection of perspectives and self-defense mechanisms dinned into us as kids in order to keep us safe.
We go on to inherit fear from others as we proceed through life, but it's something other people teach us. Don't allow your fears to control you, Jackman. See things for what they really are. Recognize them, understand them, and they won't have power over you. Tyler Kane had died in a high-speed car crash, aged 31, leaving Jackman a priceless legacy of positive thoughts. How amazing that he had thought of him now, just when he needed wise counsel. Marie came back with a mug of tea.
No coffee. My mum says we should drink more tea than coffee, and it's supposed to be good for shock, so here you are.
As she raised her mug, Jackman's mobile rang. They gave each other a long look. Jackman answered. This time Paul Lorimer sounded as if he was speaking with a gun pointed at his head. Maybe he was.
Ralph Renwick wants to speak to you and Sergeant Evans. Alone. It has to be both of you.
Jackman gritted his teeth. So this was it. The showdown.
He says, if you bring anyone else, or have any form of backup with you, there will be dire consequences.
Paul had to be reading those words. He wouldn't have a clue about dire consequences.
He also says that if you don't meet him, he will hurt people, lots of them, until you agree to listen to him.
Jackman heard a distinct tremor in his voice.
I'm listening, Paul. Is he there with you now? Can I talk to Mr. Renwick?
Pause.
He's not here.
Jackman didn't believe him for a moment.
Okay, Paul. Where does he want to meet us?
He said you would know where. And if you don't, that pretty PC stoner certainly would. Bad things have happened there.
Jackman glanced at Marie, the waste ground behind the railway line.
1 hour, or innocent blood will flow. It's your choice, D.I. Jackman.
The line crackled, then went silent. Jackman lifted his desk phone and asked for immediate triangulation on the last call to his mobile. They waited in silence.
He's still in that original area. It's walking distance from there to the river and the waste ground.
Right.
Unnaturally calm, Marie sat and sipped her tea.
It seems right, is what I mean. After all this time, all the horrible damage and destruction he's caused, it's right that it should come down to the three of us.
Jackman stared at her.
Jesus, Marie. Are you honestly thinking of meeting him? On his terms? We'd be mowed down in an instant. Look at the firepower he has.
But wait, she said. He won't just shoot us as soon as he sees us. It's not his way.
He will be compelled to tell us just how powerful he is and what failures we are. Unless he does that, he'll feel that his mission, or whatever it is, has not been fulfilled. Jackman was impressed.
When did you get a degree in psychology?
When I last spent some time with your Laura.
But what do we do?
We can't risk him spotting any backup. If he really does have hostages, and I believe he does, it will be their death sentence.
There will be no other vehicles and no firearms squad. There will be just us.
Marie put down her empty mug.
Oh, and one other. The best sniper we have. They will be concealed in the back of our own vehicle. We walk away from the car and keep Ashcroft's attention on us. The sniper slips out as soon as it's safe to do so and finds a vantage point with a clear line of sight to Ashcroft. One threatening move, and they'll finish him.
It could work, but God, it was risky.
He closed his eyes. Risky, but it would be worth it to put an end to Alistair Ashcroft's reign of terror. His eyes snapped open.
Okay, we'll do it.
He picked up the phone and called the super.
Ruth, I need the very best marksman we have, and one of the most agile. No 6'6" beefcake, please. This one needs to be a veritable lethal shadow, right? We have under an hour, and we have to do this exactly as I say, or innocent people will die. If we do this right, it ends tonight.
After he'd replaced the phone, he jumped up.
Go and get us two of the best Kevlar vests you can rake up. I'll find a car that will suit our purpose best. See you downstairs in 10.
He stopped in the doorway and looked at her, his eyes bright.
You and me, Marie. That's how we wanted it. And that's what he'll get.
You and me, Jackman. Let's go.
You excelled yourself, Paul. You've earned your money. I had intended you to do another small job with me, but I've changed my mind. Stay here for another half an hour after I've gone, then go home. Your car is in the double garage. Lock it up again when you leave and put the keys on the kitchen table.
Renwick was dressed entirely in black. Black shirt, black trousers and boots, and a heavy black body armor vest. On the floor beside him was a helmet. Paul had seen a dozen men like this on the way here, patrolling the streets. When they had gone to the rendezvous site to check it out, Renwick had dressed them both in high-vis jackets with an official-looking logo on the back. With yellow hard hats, they looked for all the world like construction workers from the other side of the river, or highway maintenance men. Renwick had said that the best place to hide was in plain sight, and no one, not even the police, had looked twice at them as they walked by. At the time, Paul had found it exciting, like being in an action movie. He rather liked being a second-in-command, although Ralph Renwick's changes of mood were hard to keep up with. Now Renwick was a police firearms officer. Paul had to hand it to him. He was in plain sight, all right. Now he understood exactly what that meant.
If things go well, Paul, it will be partly down to you, so thank you. I might not see you again, but I will get justice for your uncle.
For a moment, Paul thought that Renwick was going to hug him. He mumbled something and backed away. Renwick picked up his helmet. I've a few more things to collect, and then I'll be leaving. Remember, 30 minutes, then get out of here. Understand? Paul nodded.
I understand.
Goodbye, Paul Lorimer. Have a nice life.
Chapter 33. Despite Marie's protests, Jackman insisted on driving. To her relief, he kept to the speed limit. Slowly, the adrenaline was starting to pump through his veins. As they approached the deserted area that had once been a meeting place for mountain bikers and kids on skateboards, the enormity of what they were doing started to hit home.
Marie, I wanted to say... He struggled to find the words. I could never have asked for a better partner.
And I found a boss that I'd walk to the ends of the earth for, so no regrets, Jackman.
You two are a right barrel of laughs, said a muffled voice from the back of the Dacia estate. The tears are blurring my night vision optics. Before you start writing your wills, have a little faith, will you? Remember who's with you.
Sorry, Bert. We're not belittling your prowess, Jackman said softly. But it had to be said.
He was glad the super had arranged for Roberta Gleason to be their sniper. Not only was she a crack shot, but she was also lithe, wiry, and incredibly fit. Which she might have to be. Before they left the station, he had made sure they had the right vehicle. If luck was on their side, they would get out of the car and walk away from it. Then, under cover of darkness, Bert would slip out undetected. However, if Ashcroft suspected a trick, he would lock the car. He could do that with no problem, because the boot lid on a Dacia operated with a key and was not on the central locking system. Bert would still be able to get out with ease. And finally, he had disconnected the interior lights. The last thing he wanted was Bert opening the door and a light coming on. He had done all he could, and now it was crunch time.
Good luck, everybody, he whispered. Let's get the bastard.
Jackman took a deep breath and turned into the waste ground. He needed to find a spot in heavy shadow to give Bert the best chance of a swift and undetectable exit from the vehicle.
Over there, sir.
Marie pointed to where a single light glowed in the darkness. It was coming from the old storeroom that the Dossers used to sleep in. In the headlight beams, he made out a thick clump of wild elder shrubs growing close to a broken-down fence. He pulled up close to it and left the headlights on for a few moments. He opened his door, and Marie did the same. They paused, gathering themselves,
Then Jackman whispered, "Here we go," and slammed the door shut. He heard Marie do the same, and then a whispered voice said, "Extraction complete." Bert had used the darkness behind the headlights and made her move out of the vehicle, closing the door at the same time as Marie and slipping into the bushes. "Lock the car." The sound of Ashcroft's voice made him shudder, and then he steeled himself. He had been waiting so long for this moment. He pressed the button on the ignition key and heard the locks click. "Good. Now walk towards the building, very slowly, and with your hands in the air." Jackman couldn't quite place where the voice was coming from. It wasn't very far away. The last thing he wanted was to be in an enclosed space. That could be fatal for them both. Their guardian angel would have no clear line of fire, and they would be dead meat. Somehow, he would have to prevent them having to go inside. But as it was, he didn't need to. "Stop there. You wearing wires?" "No." "Jackman, take off your jacket and your protective vest." For a moment, Jackman hesitated, but in the end, he removed them, holding the vest up in one hand. "Drop it. Then open your shirt." Gritting his teeth against a retort, he let the jacket go and unbuttoned his shirt, exposing his chest. "No wires. Satisfied?" "Want me to do the same?" Marie called out. "And more than happy to." She stripped off the Kevlar vest, undid the top three buttons of her blouse and pulled them wide. "No wires, Alistair Ashcroft." "Enough. Do up your blouse now."
"Ooh, touchy."
"Shut up," Ashcroft growled.
"Sorry, I'm sure."
Jackman flashed her a warning glance. He admired her courage, but didn't want her taunts to trigger one of his personality swings. Even so, he took the opportunity to try and locate where Ashcroft was standing. He desperately wanted to know what kind of gun was trained on him. And it was obvious that Ashcroft had set up a light source of some kind in the doorway of the storeroom, probably a battery-powered lantern. This allowed him to see them while he remained in darkness. "I assume that there is a large force of armed policemen waiting up on the main road. I'm sure you didn't just decide to drop in on me unaccompanied," Ashcroft said, his tone even.
"For the sake of Rachel and Esther Lorimer, that's exactly what we did, Ashcroft. There is no one with us, no one waiting at the gate, nor anyone ponting up the river for that matter. You said alone, so here we are."
He spread his hands and threw the car keys towards the sound of Ashcroft's voice.
"Check the car if you like. You'll find it's not full of gun-toting coppers."
At least it isn't now. He thanked the Lord that Bert had decamped so quickly, and although there really were no cars at the gate, Ruth Crook had put Sultan in lockdown with roadblocks at every intersection.
"Where are Rachel and Esther, Ashcroft?"
called out Marie. Their voices echoed in the deserted strip of land.
"Good question."
Jackman wasn't certain, but he thought he had seen the slightest movement in the shadows slightly to the left of the storeroom. That was also the place the voice was coming from. He tried to recall what was there. A few trees, some bushes, and some piles of debris from another abandoned storeroom. Suddenly he was mighty glad that Bert had powerful night vision scopes on her gun.
"Where are they?"
Marie's voice was hard as nails.
Now, let me think."
"Why don't you get out here and face us? We've come alone, unarmed and unprotected. You, on the other hand, hold all the cards, yet you still skulk in the shadows. Coward!"
Marie seemed to have no fear at all.
"Ashcroft," Jackman called out. "She's right. Come out and face us like a man."
"And have a police sniper take me out?"
"I don't think so." "There's no fucking sniper. God, you saw us arrive. Look around you. No cars, no backup of any kind. Just us, Ashcroft."
Jackman told himself not to plead.
"Forgive me if I don't trust you, but
you see there's a lot of cover here, and with a decent rifle, even from a great distance, well,
I should know, shouldn't I?
The hint of amusement in his voice made Jackman want to rush screaming at the shadows where the killer was concealed and throttle him with his bare hands. Instead, he said,
"Then just tell us where those women are and let me ring it in so that someone can pick them up. Please, Ashcroft, at least keep that side of the bargain."
"I don't recall any bargain," said Ashcroft quietly. It had always been a possibility that he had already killed Rachel and Esther, but somehow Jackman had not believed it. Now he wasn't so certain. He looked across to Marie, but this time she remained silent. With a loud, exasperated sigh, Jackman said,
"Okay, Alistair, have it your way. Get it over with, whatever you have planned, because this is going nowhere, is it? You must want to talk, or you wouldn't have set up such an elaborate trap for us. You'd have just picked us off in the street like those other poor innocents."
Now there was a definite movement. A dark figure stepped from the shadows. In a moment of incomprehension, Jackman thought it was Bert, showing herself for some reason. Then he realized that it was Ashcroft, in a black firearm officer's uniform, complete with helmet and handgun. Clothes that must have been taken from Larry Turner's house.
"Innocence, you think?" Ashcroft sneered. "Yes, I do," Jackman replied. "You've torn that family to shreds, and for what?"
"The answer is standing right in front of me. To get to you, of course.
And let's be honest, Jackman, Ezra Lorimer is no great loss. As for the family, well," he laughed, "you did meet them, didn't you? Those kids should have been drowned at birth."
"Is that right? Well, thanks for that."
Jackman and Marie spun around to see Paul Lorimer standing just a few feet from them.
"How in hell's name?" Marie gasped. "Paul, get out of here."
But Paul was going nowhere. He stood full square facing down Ashcroft.
"Well, well, if it isn't little Paulie, you're even more stupid than I thought. You've made a big mistake coming here, and after I'd so generously spared your life. I even paid you. Dear, dear, so few brains, you're positively dangerous."
"Oh, I'm dangerous, all right, and you are evil," snarled Paul,
and pulled a gun from his jeans waistband.
"For Ezra!"
Before anyone could do or say anything, he had fired a shot at Ashcroft. The kid's aim had been true, but the shot had hit the body armor. The force of it sent Ashcroft staggering backwards, but that didn't prevent him firing his own weapon, and with a grunt, Paul fell to the ground. The next few seconds seemed to pass in a blur. Jackman heard Marie scream out,
"Bastard!"
and throw herself down beside the young man. Two shots rang out. He was pretty sure it was two. And finally, the most blood-curdling scream he could ever remember hearing. It echoed all over the waste ground and rose up into the night like the howl of some infernal hound. He spun around to see Roberta Gleason sprint past him towards Ashcroft, and two figures in dark clothes standing shoulder to shoulder a little behind and to his left. When he looked again, there was only one, and she was now running towards her fallen son.
"Rachel?"
"Paul! My Paul!"
He looked ahead to see Bert standing over the writhing figure of Ashcroft, her gun muzzle just a few inches from his head.
"Sir, paramedics required."
"I've already called them,"
Marie shouted back, who was now cradling Paul in her arms.
"For this boy, not that evil bastard, let him die."
First, Jackman went to Marie.
"Is he
still alive, but..."
Rachel appeared at Marie's side, crooning to her son.
"My brave, brave baby, don't you worry about anything. Ma's here, and she has you now, my beautiful boy."
Marie stared up at Jackman, tears welling up. Already the sirens could be heard in the distance.
"I called them just before all this happened," whispered Rachel Lorimer,
her attention all on her son.
"You are a hero, my Paul. I'm so proud of you. And Mama,"
he smiled up at her weakly,
"I'm here, my darling, and I'll never let you go."
Jackman knew that her words were now falling on deaf ears. He had seen where the bullet had entered the lad's chest. Scarlet blood pumped across his white T-shirt, and in that moment, Jackman knew his nightmare would never return. Marie took his hand.
"Leave them now," she said through her tears. "We have someone else to pay attention to."
They marched across to where Alistair Ashcroft still writhed on the filthy ground, blood gushing from both his legs.
"It just appeared in front of me," said Bert, shakily, her weapon still trained on Ashcroft's head. "Just as I was going to take my shot. I'd have killed them if I'd tried to get a shot away. It was them who shot him, sir. They kneecapped him."
Alistair Ashcroft's face was contorted in agony. He looked down at his legs.
"You just killed a kid," Marie said.
Ashcroft drew back his lips in a sneer.
"Good."
"Bert, can you close your eyes for 2 seconds? Marie turned to Jackman.
"You did not see this."
She swung her leg back and launched a kick at one of Ashcroft's shattered knees. Another howl rose into the night and lingered there, mingling with the sound of approaching two-tones.
"That's for Harvey. Now we're quits."
Marie Evans turned her back on the screaming man and walked away. Jackman looked at Bert and shrugged.
"Long story. I'll tell you sometime. Just don't ask her who Harvey is, will you?"
Epilogue.
"Guess what, sir? For once, we have some good news to give to Kenneth Harcourt."
Robbie Melton smiled happily. Jackman and Marie looked up from their undiminishing pile of reports. Jackman closed the file he'd been working on.
"Okay, spill the beans. Don't just stand there grinning."
"I was down talking to the duty sergeant at the front desk and this young bloke walks in. Says he wants to confess to a crime. Well, I was all ears, naturally." "Hurry up, Melton. What crime?"
Marie asked impatiently.
"He's admitted to driving the car that killed Kirsty Harcourt. Chris Keyes was his best mate. So, because he had been drinking and was starting a new job that week, that had to have a clean driving license, Chris took the flak. He told us that now his friend was dead, he couldn't live with himself, knowing that everyone believed Chris had run a girl down and not stopped."
"Well, I'm absolutely delighted to hear that," said Marie. "Kenneth Harcourt will finally be able to stop wondering what really happened."
"And now someone has accepted the blame, perhaps we'll be able to move on," added Jackman.
"I was told he's selling the gun club," said Marie, "and his private collection."
"I heard that too. He's probably had enough of guns and the heartbreak they cause."
Jackman remembered the look on Harcourt's face when he discovered that it was his gun that had killed his friend Arthur.
"We'll take a trip out this afternoon, Marie, and give him the news."
"Oh, good. And please, this time, can I ask him why his house is called Wits End? Go on, let me..."
He laughed. "Okay, if you must. But try to be tactful."
It was a good feeling to be delivering positive news for once. He and Marie had spent a lot of time with Rachel Lorimer and her family recently. They had come away full of respect for the way she had managed all those years with no help. And then Ashcroft in his guise as kind Uncle Ezra had done such damage to them. Laura had offered to talk to them, especially Jacob, who was suffering from the loss of his brother, and it did seem to be helping.
"Boss, would you have time to sit down with the rest of us and fill in a few gaps?" Robbie asked.
"Sure. Is the team all in the CID room now?"
"Yes, sir."
"Then get everyone a drink."
He passed Robbie a handful of coins. "And I'll be out in 5. Jackman perched on the edge of Marie's desk and began.
"First, Sam Page is out of hospital and recovering well. He's staying with us at Mill Corner for a while until he can cope on his own. He sends his regards to you all."
"He gave us a fright, all right," said Gary. "Poor guy, what a shock. I'm really glad he's doing well."
"And you'll be pleased to hear that Kevin Stoner will be joining us at the end of the month. He's another one recovering from damage Alistair Ashcroft inflicted."
Jackman looked at the assembled team.
"So, loose ends?"
"What will happen to Ashcroft, sir?"
asked Robbie.
"As you know, he's on remand until his trial,
and then it will be down to the judge and jury to decide. He frowned. We have enough evidence to lock him up for life, but the question will be whether he's of sound mind. His defense might claim not guilty by reason of insanity, or possibly that he's guilty, but insane or mentally ill, which would mean he'd be committed to a psychiatric facility.
Is there a chance the jury will decide that he'd been perfectly in command of his faculties when he committed those atrocities? That he is simply an evil killer?
Asked Charlie Button. Jackman shrugged. There is a chance, of course. Then he would go to a Cat A maximum security prison somewhere like Franklin or Wakefield.
Where he belongs with the other monsters, muttered Max. One thing's for sure, he won't be doing a runner, not with no kneecaps.
It's in the lap of the gods, isn't it, sir? Said Marie. Let's hope he comes up against a shit-hot prosecution lawyer out to make a name for themselves.
Plus one of those judges that would bring back hanging if they had half a chance, added Max.
For once, they were able to laugh at Ashcroft's expense. They had spent years with his presence hanging over them, like the sword of Damocles. And of all people, it was the crazy Lorimer family that had given them the freedom to joke again. Jackman looked at the team, relaxed and cheerful once more.
Listen up, guys. You will all be wanting to know exactly what happened that night. There's been a lot of rumours going the rounds, I know, but Superintendent Crook wanted to keep things under wraps until some of the trickier details had been sorted out.
About poor Lorimer? Asked Robbie.
And the part his mother and sister played in it. Jackman got off the desk and brought a chair over to the group. This is where it gets a bit complicated. Ashcroft lured Paul to where he was staying by deliberately leaving a letter with an address where Paul would find it. Paul went to look for him in order to punish him for murdering Ezra, and Ashcroft ambushed him. He then spun Paul a whole web of lies about being best buddies with Ezra, swearing he wasn't responsible for his murder. Paul pretended to fall for his story. Ashcroft then offered him a lot of money to help him set up a secret meeting between him, Marie, and I, ostensibly to clear his name. Paul suspected it was a crock of shit, but at this point he decided he could have the best of both worlds, keep the money and take revenge on Ashcroft for the damage he'd done to his family.
I thought he was a bit slow, but that took brains and cunning. Gary looked puzzled. Rachel told me that he was academically challenged, sometimes childish, had anger issues and could be pretty unstable. But he wasn't stupid. Paul wasn't about to trust Ashcroft out of the lies he'd told, but he was scared of him. Ashcroft made two mistakes with Paul. He underestimated him, and he had no idea that he had a mobile phone and the gun hidden in his car.
Sloppy.
Max smiled like the Cheshire Cat. So, on Ashcroft's orders, Paul made the phone call to his mother saying he'd got drunk and was sleeping it off. Then, as soon as Ashcroft went out, Paul phoned her again on his hidden mobile, one she knew nothing about, incidentally, told her the truth and explained what Ashcroft was planning. Gary exhaled.
But wasn't Ashcroft going to kill him?
I'm guessing Paul hadn't worked that one out. Probably not. But what he did realize was that Ashcroft didn't want to talk to Marie and me at all. He wanted to kill us. And Paul wasn't going to let that happen. Then he realized he'd bitten off more than he could chew, and so asked for his mother's help.
According to Rachel, said Marie, Ashcroft had done enough damage without killing little Marie Evans and that boss of hers. She reckons he's all right, that Jackman, for a copper, that is.
They all laughed.
So Paul made that desperate call to you about Ashcroft abducting his mother, and it was all acting? Asked Charlie.
Very good acting, too. His life depended on it. But he'd already told his ma where the meeting was to be, and she enlisted Esther to help her.
So they loaded their guns and went to save you two? Max spluttered. Blimey!
They had no idea we had a marksman with us, and Rachel had no idea that Paul would show up either, Jackman sighed. Let alone get himself killed. The arrangement was that he would go straight home with the money.
What happened to that money, sir?
Asked Robbie. There was no sign of it anywhere. We can only think he hid it, Jackman said.
Marie glanced at him. One thing bothers me, boss, said Max. The guns they used.
They only had air guns at the farm. They would have hurt the bugger, but not kneecapped him.
Jackman nodded to Marie.
Tell him, Marie.
I always wondered what Esther's problem was. As you know, every member of that family is fragile in one way or another. But she seemed so normal, other than being a bit of a hoarder.
Marie gave them a rather sad smile.
Turns out she wasn't a hoarder. She stole things. That's why she lost her job and Rachel kept her at home. She stole her grandfather's shotgun and kept it hidden in her van for years. And she stole the handgun that Paul had.
Bloody hell. Where did she nick that from?
Last I heard, they don't sell them in Tesco,
Robbie exclaimed.
It belonged to a chap who used to give her a lift home from work sometimes. He was a Russian working in a food processing plant close to town, not far from where Esther worked, and he lived out near Hawker's Fen. She took it from the glove compartment of his van.
And it was unlicensed, of course, so he didn't dare report it, added Gary.
And luckily for Esther, even if he had guessed she was the thief, he was deported shortly after.
Geez, it all happens out at Hawker's Fen, doesn't it?
Said Charlie.
So, what's going to happen to Rachel?
Asked Max.
I'm totally with her for taking a shotgun to that bastard, but you can't just go around shooting people. It's against the law.
Jackman leaned back in his chair.
Well, as you know, she's been interviewed. She can't claim self-defense because Ashcroft wasn't trying to kill her when she shot him, so I'm thinking she'll get a conviction, but certainly no custodial sentence. She was in possession of an unlicensed shotgun, and she used it. But when you consider the situation, there are plenty of other circumstances to take into account. She'll be okay, I'm sure. And hopefully she'll get some help at last.
And Esther?
Asked Charlie.
Her air rifle needed no license, and oddly, both guns have disappeared. Jacob tells me that immediately after Paul was shot, Esther brought them home on Rachel's orders, and gave them to Levi, who took them to his shed and sawed the barrels in half with his circular saw. He then threw them in the river.
Jackman gave a half smile.
Jacob was delighted with Levi for doing that, and his elder brother has really gone up in his estimation.
Guess that just about wraps it up, doesn't it? Said Robbie.
Thanks, boss.
One small thing, but I think it's pretty important. You should like this, Robbie.
Jackman really did smile this time. Clay Bullimore, the man whose horse was stolen, is going to offer Jacob a permanent job at his stables. He reckoned that a lad with his knowledge and understanding of horses will be a real asset. Oh, and he's beefed up security at the stables.
Brilliant, said Robbie.
Excellent result.
Excellent result all round, I'd say, said Jackman.
Now we can get on with our lives again.
It's really over,
Marie whispered.
Jackman sighed. Yes, this time it really is.
Sometime around 7 that evening, Jackman and Laura left Sam watching television and walked across to the mill. The transformation was impressive.
Think you can work here? Jackman asked.
It's perfect. Being that little way from the house means it won't intrude on our everyday life.
She gazed up at Jackman, eyes sparkling.
I couldn't have wished for anything better. It's so peaceful here in the village.
And it was. For the first time, Jackman could walk in his garden, breathe in the fresh fen air, and not look over his shoulder. Emotion washed over him, and he reached for Laura's hand, clasping it tightly.
We have a future, don't we, Laura? Now that he's gone.
Yes, of course we do. It's like emerging from some terrible nightmare. Some awful dark and dangerous place and feeling the sun on your face again.
He nodded.
Speaking of nightmares, sweetheart.
Laura looked at him thoughtfully. He leaned forward and kissed her.
What nightmares?
That evening, Marie rode her bike out to Hawker's Fen. Rachel greeted her with an offer of tea and the warmest smile she'd ever worn. Though her eyes were still puffy from the tears she'd shed over the loss of her boy, she also looked a little like Marie's team did, as if a fire had been rekindled within her. Marie told her about Clay Bullimore's offer of a job for Jacob, and the tears fell again, this time for joy.
I understand he'll be stable boy in charge of Nimbus's well-being,
and he'll be able to ride him and everything. A proper paid job. Will he accept it, Rachel?
What do you think? Said Rachel, snuffling. It'll be the making of him.
Marie sipped her tea, made in a pot, with real leaves. Rachel permitted herself a single extravagance, proper tea.
I'm sorry you have to go through all this legal stuff, Rachel, but Jackman is pulling every string he can to help you. We are right by you this time.
Rachel nodded.
You know, I'd have gone to prison for that wicked man. I should have aimed a whole lot higher than his knee.
Why did you send Esther home?
I didn't want her seeing Paul like that. And I didn't want her taken to the station and questioned. Not then. I knew it would have to happen, but not with her brother dying in front of her. I just told her to go home, give the guns to Levi and look after the family.
A pellet hit his other knee dead centre and split his kneecap in half. The surgeon apparently said it was a chance in a million.
I always knew she was the best shot of the lot of them. That's why I took her with me.
The shotgun did a perfect job too, Rachel. I must say, I wonder which of you fired that particular gun.
Marie looked at her knowingly.
You said it was you, so I have to accept that, but...
More tea.
Thank you.
She smiled to herself. Rachel's reticence to answer confirmed Marie's belief that it had been Esther who'd fired the unlicensed shotgun, and Rachel's skillfulness that destroyed Ashcroft's knee with an air gun. She had just been trying to protect her daughter from a more serious charge. Marie took a paper package from her jacket pocket and pushed it across the table.
Our secret, Rachel. Don't tell a soul, you understand? Your boy wanted you to have this, and in my opinion, he earned it, every penny.
Blood money,
sighed Rachel Lorimer, not touching it.
No, this was his gift to you. He wanted to do something to support the family he loved. Take it. It doesn't belong to anyone else. It belonged to Paul, and I'm sure he was proud to have secured it for you. If he had come home like he was supposed to, he would have taken such pride in giving it to you.
Rachel peeked inside the envelope and gasped.
Are you sure you won't get into trouble?
No one knows. Just us.
And as far as everyone else is concerned, he hid it. And no one knows where. End of story. Rachel Lorimer closed her eyes and sighed.
End of story.
She picked up the envelope and put it in a drawer in her kitchen dresser.
More tea, little Marie Evans.
This has been an Audible Studios production of The Patient Man, written by Joy Ellis and performed by Richard Armitage. Copyright by Joy Ellis, 2019. Production copyright 2020 by Audible Limited. Audible Studios is a division of Audible Limited.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this program.